Luther before the legate. Chapter 5. De Vio. Immediately on his arrival, and before seeing anyone, Luther, desirous of showing the legate all due respect, begged Link to go and announce his presence. Link did so, and respectfully informed the cardinal, on the part of the Wittenberg doctor, that the latter was ready to appear before him whenever he should give the order. The legate was delighted at this news. At last he had this impetuous heretic within his reach, and promised himself that the reformer should not quit the walls of Augsburg as he had entered them. At the same time that Link waited upon the legate, the monk Leonard went to inform Staupitz of Luther's arrival. The vicar general had written to the doctor that he would certainly come and see him as soon as he knew that he had reached Augsburg. Luther was unwilling to lose a minute in informing him of his presence. The diet was over. The emperor and the electors had already separated. The emperor, it is true, had not yet quitted the place, but was hunting in the neighborhood. The ambassador of Rome remained alone in Augsburg. If Luther had gone thither during the diet, he would have met with powerful supporters, but everything now seemed destined to bend beneath the weight of the papal authority. The name of the judge before whom Luther was to appear was not calculated to encourage him. Thomas de Vio, surnamed Cajetan, from the town of Gaeta in the kingdom of Naples, where he was born in 1469, had given great promise from his youth. At 16, he had entered the Dominican order, contrary to the express will of his parents. He had afterwards become general of his order, and cardinal of the Roman Church. But what was worse for Luther, this learned doctor was one of the most zealous defenders of that scholastic theology which the reformer had always treated during her pregnancy, that St. Thomas in person would instruct the child to which she was about to give birth, and would introduce him into heaven. Accordingly, de Vio, when he became a Dominican, had changed his name from James to Thomas. He had zealously defended the prerogatives of the papacy, and the doctrines of Thomas Aquinas, whom he looked upon as the pearl of theologians. Fond of pageantry and show, he construed almost seriously the Roman maxim that legates are above kings, and surrounded himself with a brilliant train. On the August 1st, he had performed a solemn mass in the Cathedral of Augsburg, and in the presence of all the princes of the empire, had placed the cardinal's hat on the head of the Archbishop of Mentz, who knelt before him, and had delivered to the emperor himself the hat and sword which the pope had consecrated. Such was the man before whom the Wittenberg monk was about to appear, dressed in a frock that did not belong to him. Further, the legate's learning, the austerity of his disposition, and the purity of his morals, ensured him an influence and authority in Germany that other Roman courtiers would not easily have obtained. It was no doubt to this reputation for sanctity that he owed this mission. Rome perceived that it would admirably forward her designs. Thus, even the good qualities of Cajetan rendered him still more formidable. Besides, the affair entrusted to him was by no means complicated. Luther was already declared a heretic. If he would not retract, the legate must send him to prison, and if he escaped, whoever should give him an asylum was to be excommunicated. This was what the dignitary of the church, before whom Luther was summoned, had to perform on behalf of Rome. Luther had recovered his strength during the night. On Saturday morning, October 8th, being already reinvigorated after his journey, he began to consider his strange position. He was resigned, and awaited the manifestation of God's will by the course of events. He had not long to wait. A person, unknown to him, sent to say, as if entirely devoted to him, that he was about to pay him a visit, and that Luther should avoid appearing before the legate until after this interview. The message proceeded from an Italian courtier named Urban of Serralonga, who had often visited Germany as envoy from the Margrave of Montferrat. He had known the Elector of Saxony, to whom he had been accredited, and after the Margrave's death, he had attached himself to the Cardinal de Vio. The art and address of this individual presented the most striking contrast with the noble frankness and generous integrity of Luther. The Italian soon arrived at the Augustine Monastery. The cardinal had sent him to sound the reformer, and prepare him for the recantation expected from him. Serralonga imagined that his sojourn in Germany had given him a great advantage over the other courtiers in the legate's train. He hoped to make short work with this German monk. He arrived attended by two domestics, and professed to have come of his own accord, from friendship towards a favorite of the Elector of Saxony, and from attachment to the Holy Church. After having most cordially saluted Luther, the diplomatist added in an affectionate manner, I am come to offer you good advice. Be wise, and become reconciled with the church. Submit to the cardinal without reserve. Retract your offensive language. Remember the Abbot Joachim of Florence. He had published, as you know, many heretical things, and yet he was declared no heretic, because he retracted his errors. Upon this Luther spoke of justifying what he had done. Serra Longa. Beware of that. Would you enter the lists against the legate of his holiness? Luther. If they convince me of having taught anything contrary to the Roman Church, I shall be my own judge, and immediately retract. The essential point will be to know whether the legate relies on the authority of St. Thomas more than the faith will sanction. If he does so, I will not yield. Serra Longa. Oh. You intend to break a lance then? The Italian then began to use language which Luther styles horrible. He argued that one might maintain false propositions, provided they brought in money and filled the treasury, that all discussion in the universities against the Pope's authority must be avoided, that, on the contrary, it should be asserted that the Pope could, by a single nod, change or suppress articles of faith, and so he ran on, in a similar strain. But the wily Italian soon perceived that he was forgetting himself, and returning to his mild language, he endeavored to persuade Luther to submit to the legate in all things, and to retract his doctrine, his oaths, and his theses. The doctor, who was at first disposed to credit the fair professions of the Order Urban, as he calls him in his narrative, was now convinced that they were of little worth, and that he was much more on the legate's side than on his. He consequently became less communicative, and was content to say that he was disposed to show all humility, to give proofs of his obedience, and render satisfaction in those things in which he might have erred. At these words Serra Longa exclaimed joyfully, I shall hasten to the legate. You will follow me presently. Everything will go well, and all will soon be settled. He went away. The Saxon monk, who had more discernment than the Roman courtier, thought to himself, This crafty Sinan has been badly taught and trained by his Greeks. Luther was in suspense between hope and fear, yet hope prevailed. The visit and the strange professions of Serra Longa, whom he afterwards called a bungling mediator, revived his courage. The counselors and other inhabitants of Augsburg, to whom the elector had recommended Luther, were all eager to see the monk whose name already resounded throughout Germany. Puttinger, the imperial counselor, one of the most eminent patricians of the city, who frequently invited Luther to his table, the counselor Langmantel, Dr. Auerbach of Leipzig, the two brothers of Adelman, both canons, and many more, repaired to the Augustine convent. They cordially saluted this extraordinary man, who had undertaken so long a journey to place himself in the hands of the Roman agents. Have you a safe conduct? Asked they. No, replied the intrepid monk. What boldness! They all exclaimed. It was a polite expression, says Luther, to designate my rashness and folly. All unanimously entreated him not to visit the legate before obtaining a safe conduct from the emperor himself. It is probable the public had already heard something of the Pope's brief, of which the legate was the bearer. But, replied Luther, I set out for Augsburg without a safe conduct, and have arrived safely. The elector has recommended you to us. You ought therefore to obey us, and do all that we tell you, answered Langmantel affectionately but firmly. Dr. Auerbach coincided with these views and added, We know that at the bottom of his heart the cardinal is exceedingly irritated against you. One cannot trust these Italians. The canon Adelman urged the same thing. You have been sent without protection, and they have forgotten to provide you with that which you needed most. His friends undertook to obtain the requisite safe conduct from the emperor. They then told Luther how many persons, even in elevated rank, had a leaning in his favor. The minister of France himself, who left Augsburg a few days ago, has spoken of you in the most honorable manner. This remark struck Luther, and he remembered it afterwards. Thus several of the most respectable citizens in one of the first cities of the empire were already gained over to the Reformation. The conversation had reached this point when Serra Longa returned. Come, said he to Luther. The cardinal is waiting for you. I will myself conduct you to him. But you must first learn how to appear in his presence. When you enter the room in which he is, you will prostrate yourself with your face to the ground. When he tells you to rise, you will kneel before him, and you will wait his further orders before you stand up. Remember, you are about to appear before a prince of the church. As for the rest, fear nothing, all will speedily be settled without difficulty. Luther, who had promised to follow this Italian as soon as he was invited, found himself in a dilemma. However, he did not hesitate to inform him of the advice of his Augsburg friends, and spoke of a safe conduct. "Beware of asking for anything of the kind," immediately replied Serra Longa. "You do not require one. The legate is kindly disposed towards you, and ready to end this business in a friendly manner. If you ask for a safe conduct, you will ruin everything." "My gracious lord, the Elector of Saxony," replied Luther, "recommended me to several honorable men in this city. They advised me to undertake nothing without a safe conduct. I ought to follow their advice. For if I did not, and anything should happen, they will write to the Elector, my master, that I would not listen to them." Luther persisted in his determination, and Serra Longa was compelled to return to his chief, and announce the shoal on which his mission had struck, at the very moment he flattered himself with success. Thus terminated the conferences of that day with the Order of Montferrat. Another invitation was sent to Luther, but with a very different view. John Frosch, prior of the Carmelites, was an old friend. 2 years before, as licentiate in theology, he had defended some theses, under the presidence of Luther. He came to see him, and begged him earnestly to come and stay with him. He claimed the honor of entertaining the Doctor of Germany as his guest. Already men did not fear to pay him homage even in the face of Rome. Already the weak had become stronger. Luther accepted the invitation, and left the convent of the Augustines for that of the Carmelites. The day did not close without serious reflections. Serra Longa's eagerness and the fears of the counselors alike pointed out the difficulties of Luther's position. Nevertheless, he had God in heaven for his protector. Guarded by him, he could sleep without fear. The next day was Sunday, on which he obtained a little more repose. Yet he had to endure fatigues of another kind. All the talk of the city was about Dr. Luther, and everybody desired to see, as he wrote to Melanchthon, this new Erostratus, who had caused so vast a conflagration. They crowded round him in his walks, and the good doctor smiled, no doubt, at this singular excitement. But he had to undergo importunities of another kind. If the people were desirous of seeing him, they had a still greater wish to hear him. He was requested on all sides to preach. Luther had no greater joy than to proclaim the gospel. It would have delighted him to preach Jesus Christ in this large city, and in the solemn circumstances in which he was placed. But he evinced on this occasion, as on many others, a just sentiment of propriety, and great respect for his superiors. He refused to preach, for fear the legate should think he did it to annoy and to brave him. This moderation and this discretion were assuredly as good as a sermon. The cardinal's people, however, did not permit him to remain quiet. They renewed their persuasions. "The cardinal," said they, "gives you assurances of his grace and favor. What are you afraid of?" They employed 1,000 reasons to persuade him to wait upon Davai. "He is a very merciful father," said one of these enders. But another approached and whispered in his ear, "Do not believe what they tell you. He never keeps his word." Luther persisted in his resolution. On Monday morning, October 10th, Serra Longa again returned to the charge. The courtier had made it a point of honor to succeed in his negotiation. He had scarcely arrived when he said in Latin, "Why do you not wait upon the cardinal? He is expecting you most indulgently. The whole matter lies in 6 letters, revoca, retract. Come, you have nothing to fear." Luther thought to himself that these 6 letters were very important ones, but without entering into any discussion on the merits of the things to be retracted, he replied, "I will appear as soon as I have safe conduct." Serra Longa lost his temper on hearing these words. He insisted he made fresh representations, but Luther was immovable. Becoming still more angry, he exclaimed, "You imagine, no doubt, that the Elector will take up arms in your defense, and for your sake run the risk of losing the territories he received from his forefathers?" Luther: "God forbid." Serra Longa: "When all forsake you, where will you take refuge?" Luther, looking to heaven with an eye of faith: "Under heaven." Serra Longa was silent for a moment, struck with the sublimity of this unexpected answer. He then resumed the conversation. "What would you do if you held the legate, pope, and cardinals in your hands as they have you now in theirs?" Luther: "I would show them all possible honor and respect. But with me, the word of God is before everything." Serra Longa, smiling, and snapping his fingers in the manner of the Italians, All honor. I do not believe a word of it. He then went out, sprung into his saddle, and disappeared. Sarah Longa did not return to Luther, but he long remembered the resistance he had met with from the reformer, and that which his master was soon after to experience in person. We shall find him at a later period loudly calling for Luther's blood. Sarah Longa had not long quitted the doctor when the safe conduct arrived. Luther's friends had obtained it from the imperial counselors. It is probable that the latter had consulted the emperor on the subject, as he was not far from Augsburg. It would even appear from what the cardinal said afterwards, that from unwillingness to displease him, his consent also had been asked. Perhaps this was the reason why Sarah Longa was set to work upon Luther, for open opposition to the security of a safe conduct would have disclosed intentions that it was desirable to keep secret. It was a safer plan to induce Luther himself to desist from the demand. But they soon found out that the Saxon monk was not a man to give way. Luther was now to appear. In demanding a safe conduct, he did not lean upon an arm of flesh, for he was fully aware that an imperial safe conduct had not preserved John Huss from the stake. He only wished to do his duty by submitting to the advice of his master's friends. The Lord will decide his faith. If God should require his life, he is ready joyfully to resign it. At this solemn moment he felt the need of communing once again with his friends, above all with Melanchthon, who was so dear to his heart, and he took advantage of a few moments of leisure to write to him. "Show yourself a man," said he, "as you do at all times. Teach our beloved youths what is upright and acceptable to God. As for me, I am going to be sacrificed for you and for them, if such is the Lord's will. I would rather die, and even, which would be my greatest misfortune, be forever deprived of your sweet society, than retract what I felt in my duty to teach, and thus ruin perhaps by my own fault the excellent studies to which we are now devoting ourselves. Italy, like Egypt in times of old, is plunged in darkness so thick that it may be felt. No one in that country knows anything of Christ, or of what belongs to him, and yet they are our lords and our masters in faith and in morals. Thus the wrath of God is fulfilled among us, as the prophet saith, 'I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them.' Do your duty to God, my dear Philip, and avert his anger by pure and fervent prayer." The legate, being informed that Luther would appear before him on the morrow, assembled the Italians and Germans in whom he had the greatest confidence, in order to concert with them the method he should pursue with the Saxon monk. Their opinions were divided. "We must compel him to retract," said one. "We must seize him and put him in prison," said another. "It would be better to put him out of the way," thought a third. "They should try to win him over by gentleness and mildness," was the opinion of a fourth. The cardinal seems to have resolved on beginning with the last method.